Good evening, everyone, and it's really good to be with you. It's such a pleasure and an honour to be with you. My name is Jim Crooks. I serve as an elder and Bible teacher in the Crescent Church in South Belfast, and I spend a lot of my time working with students, pretending to listen to them. So it's a real pleasure to be with you, and I want to begin, because our topic tonight is how we treat the earth, does it matter? And so I want to begin by reading with you the most majestic opening of any piece of literature, the first verses of Genesis chapter 1. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, can I say that you're particularly welcome? I'm going to treat or do my best to treat our subject seriously. I'm not simply going to use it as an excuse to harangue you. I'm going to take our subject seriously. And so we'll begin by reading these majestic words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And we'll drop down to verse 9. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. In the year 1977, NASA launched its Voyager 1 spacecraft and sent it into outer space, and it passed by Jupiter and Saturn and on into interstellar space. And today, it is 14.5 billion miles away from Earth. But just a few years into its travels, the scientists came to that point where it was about to leave our solar system, and they turned the spacecraft around so that it effectively could take a selfie of the Earth, one last photo of planet Earth. And at that immense distance, the Earth was just a pale blue dot. And the atheist scientist Carl Sagan is remembered for making a speech called "The Pale Blue Dot." And he says this: "Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you have heard of, every human being who ever was lived out their lives, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every sinner and saint in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam." For most of history, human beings have taken the earth for granted. It was this unshakable thing, the one truly solid thing we could rely upon. But in recent decades, a feeling of uncertainty has entered our culture. Even fear has gripped many people because it is believed that the planet is in trouble. The entire scientific establishment warns us of an ecological disaster. Protest groups like Extinction Rebellion have tapped into a passionate desire amongst teenagers and young people today, young adults today, to make radical change, to change the way we travel, the way we eat and consume products. The number of vegans in the UK has quadrupled. I once had to give a talk on veganism. Yes, I didn't have a lot of credibility, but anyway. So some of the Christian students who had invited me to talk on this subject suspected I knew nothing about it. And so they asked, in fact demanded, that the week before I had to go on a vegan diet to try and build some empathy with the likely audience. But their plan completely backfired, because by the time I came to give the talk, I was so angry that I didn't really even take any questions, and I immediately drove up to McDonald's on Carrie Duff afterwards. But it is amazing, the number of vegans in the UK. It is quite likely, you know, in 20 years' time that meat eaters will be regarded the way cigarette smokers are regarded today. In this talk, I'm going to try and ask and answer four questions. First, we'll address the question, is planet Earth in trouble? Is the threat of an ecological disaster a real one, or is it just hype? Secondly, I want to think about the relationship between humans and planet Earth. What is our relationship to the Earth? And we're going to discover that all the problems we have created as a race come from getting our relationship with the Earth wrong. Thirdly, we need to answer a really practical question. How should we treat the Earth? But I want to finish by asking the most basic question of all. What is the Earth for? Does it have a purpose? And if so, what might that purpose be? So, that's the plan. I should say up front, for those of you who are not Christians, that I will be coming at these four questions from a Christian perspective. There are some non-Christians who blame Christianity for messing up the planet. They argue that Christianity is responsible for our mindset that has encouraged men down through the centuries to plunder and to vandalize the Earth's resources. So I'm going to try and answer those charges as we move through the four questions. So let's begin with the simple factual question. Is planet Earth in trouble? Are those warnings of impending doom real? Well, there is no doubt that some of the warnings are exaggerated. There's a well-known politician in the United States called Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, and she famously said some years ago, "We have 12 years to save the world. The world will end in 12 years if we don't change." It's that sort of apocalyptic vision that's terrifying millions of teenagers today. Psychologists will tell you that eco-anxiety is a serious problem amongst young adults. Way back in 1989, the United Nations published a position paper that predicted that entire nations could be wiped off the face of the Earth if global warming trend was not reversed by the year 2000. So those are just obvious examples of exaggerated threats being made. But more sober-minded scientists have concluded that we will face really difficult challenges over the next century. And those challenges can be sorted into two categories. There's a thing called climate change, and then there is the collapse in biodiversity, where mass extinctions of species occur. And so we'll think about those two challenges in turn. The planet's average temperature has risen about 0.9 degrees Celsius since the 19th century. But the interesting thing is that most of that change, that warming, has occurred in the past 35 years. The evidence linking the temperature rise to our use of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, is compelling. Scientists put their certainty at 95%. Now, why do I say that? Because that's higher than the certainty that smoking causes lung cancer. Now, I mention that because people who deny climate change have a big problem on their hands. You see, we don't need 100% certainty before deciding to act. That would be like a lung cancer patient arguing that they need not give up smoking because the link between smoking and cancer isn't 100% proved. Now, the consequences of climate change are difficult to predict. We can see its effect in retreating glaciers, shrinking ice sheets, increased acidification of the oceans. But maybe the main consequence will be extreme weather conditions. So now, the changes in the Earth's processes operate over very long time periods, so we should be suspicious of claims that every storm or heat wave is a consequence of climate change, and I wish the BBC would listen to that last sentence. But the settled view of the scientific community is that long-term climate change will increase droughts, floods, and other extreme weather conditions. And it's people living in the global south in places like Bangladesh who will suffer the most. Then there is the thing called biodiversity. Now, there is a natural or a background biodiversity loss where, you know, species are going extinct all the time. But the current rate of extinction is at least 1,000 times higher than the background rate. Marine life has been the hardest hit. Half of the different species of fish eaten by humans have become extinct since 1970. The main reason for the collapse in biodiversity is the destruction of natural habitats. Human agriculture has replaced 70% of the world's grasslands, 50% of savanna, 45% of deciduous forest, and 27% of tropical forest. In 2014, 45 million acres of tree cover was cut down. Now, that's a region twice the size of Portugal. The main cause isn't subsistence farmers clearing fields. It's the drive for biofuels and the vast soybean fields needed to produce animal feed for beef farmers. So it might seem that the answer to my question, is the planet in trouble, is a straightforward yes. But I don't need to tell you that the question is in fact highly politicized. About a year ago, Sir David Attenborough broadcast a program called Extinction on the BBC. Now, Attenborough is the closest thing the progressive left has to a saint. And he ended the program with a monologue straight to camera, saying in effect that we were teetering on the edge of disaster because human activity will lead to the extinction of millions of life forms on the planet. 2 days after that program was broadcast, the Spectator magazine had an article rubbishing the BBC programme. It described it as one-sided green propaganda, a hysterical picture of apocalypse caused by capitalism. And that story illustrates just how political the debate over ecology has become. You have the woke liberals of the BBC on one side and the right-wing humanists of the Spectator on the other side. So we have complicated science wrapped up in the middle of a political dogfight. For the purposes of this talk, I'm going to proceed on the basis that the ecological challenges we face are real and significant. I fully accept that it's a political minefield, but here's the thing. The prospect of ecological disaster shouldn't come as a surprise to Christians. In the Bible, the wrath of God in history usually takes the form of God handing humanity over to experience the consequences of its own rebellion, of its own sin. And anyone who has read the book of Revelation will know that the consequence of unbridled consumption, consumerism, is a series of ecological disasters. So Christians, more than any other group of people, should expect the planet to be vulnerable to humanity's excesses. My second question is going to allow us to think about the spiritual roots of the problem. What is humanity's relationship to planet Earth? And I'm going to suggest there are two wrong answers to that question, and then, being a Christian, the Christian answer is the right one. Maybe you should start with the wrong answers, the ideologies of the right and the left. In simple terms, we can characterize the right-wing view of ecology as the modernist view, and the left-wing view as postmodernist. So in the 17th and 18th centuries, the modern way of thinking about the world arose. God was banished from the heavens, and man became the measure of things. He stood alone in the universe. It was the human spirit that would triumph over all our foes. A modernist like Francis Bacon declared, man had become, and here's the phrase, the master of nature. Nature was a thing to be cultivated and brought under control. Every bit of wasteland was to be transformed into a garden or a farmland. So we could tear up forests to build our cities because the earth was man's plaything. In a universe where only the fittest survive, human beings had triumphed over all the other species on earth. So modern man set about mastering nature. That is in many ways what the scientific revolution and the industrial revolution were all about. The triumph of man over nature. So modernity poisoned our understanding of the human relationship to nature. Then, in the middle of the 20th century, that great project crashed and burned. And this thing called postmodernism took over. And at this point, the big story of humanity's triumphal march was ditched. And so we started to see the rise of I'm sure you've heard of politics of identity, started to drive the left's political thinking. So today, the left sees all of life as a struggle between an oppressor and a victim group. That's why they talk about the white heteropatriarchy and white privilege. Women are told to break free from the oppression of men. The LGBT community's story is the escape from oppressive restrictions. And that same model is now applied to ecology, except now the oppressor is humanity itself and Mother Earth is the victim. Okay? Humanity, especially Western industrialists, are now the hated oppressor and cute polar bear cubs are the victims. So the left's answer to the ecological problem is to overthrow the entire system of capitalism. In its most extreme forms, the left is anti-human. The Earth needs to be saved from its cruel human oppressor. So my position is that both the right and the left-wing views of humanity's relationship to nature are wrong. The right taught us that man is the master of nature. Nature is our plaything. We can do whatever we want with it because we won the survival of the fittest game. And then the left positions humanity as the hated oppressor who must be overthrown if the planet is to be freed from our evil grip. Turning to the Christian perspective, we need to start by asking, what is God's relationship to his creation? And the answer is simple. He loves it. Read Genesis 1 and that recurring phrase, and God saw that it was good. God thought creation was good before we came along. He loves trees and flowers and giraffes and dolphins. One of the most moving parts of Matthew's gospel is when the Lord Jesus tells us that our Father in heaven watches when a little sparrow falls to the ground. John talks about God's care for the raven and the lioness. Job does. One of the reasons God didn't destroy the wicked city of Nineveh was because its hills were filled with cattle. So that gives us the right foundation. When we are called to give an account of our lives to God, one of the things he will ask us is, how well did we look after the creation he loves? I'm going to suggest three principles here. First, humans are part of the community of creatures. I would encourage anyone who seeks biblical wisdom in these matters to start reading Job chapters 38 and 39. For starters, they contain some of the greatest poetry ever written. I love them. God takes Job on this great tour of his creation. He shows him a doe crouching down as she gives birth to her young. He makes Job listen to the braying of a wild donkey. He shows him a war horse rearing up in excitement as it charges at the enemy. Now, the end of Job is a really deep reservoir of theology. But on the surface, it reminds us that human beings are part of the community of creatures. We are. We were formed from the dust. So there is a kinship with the rest of nature. We aren't alien overlords who control the rest of nature. So that first principle answers the right-wing view of the man-nature relationship. But the second and third of my principles will answer the left-wing view. The second principle is that humans are uniquely valuable. Why? Because we are God's image bearers. We are made in the image of God. Never forget the huge gulf that exists between a human being and an animal. Yes, we are part of the community of creatures. We are formed from dust. But we are also made in the image of God. We are magnificent, moral, rational, spiritual creatures made in God's image. We have souls that will last forever. If you read Genesis 1 carefully, you will see there is as big a gulf between inanimate life, like a rock, and animate life, as there is between an animal and a human. This is where ethical veganism goes wrong, in my opinion. Provided that animals are well cared for, it is the Bible's position that in this fallen world, it is acceptable to kill animals for food. And the reason is that there is a huge gulf between a mere animal and a human being. So be careful that concern for animal welfare is motivated by a high view of animals and not a low view of humanity. Having said that, animal welfare should be high up on our list of priorities. The third principle is that human beings have responsibility for the welfare of creation. We're called to cultivate it. Not everything humans do is an act of vandalism. We can live in such a way that the creation supports all living creatures in a mutually respectful way. But that requires us to feel a sense of responsibility for climate change, the collapse in biodiversity, and for animal welfare. My third question is a really practical one. How should we treat the earth? For the Christian, the key text here is again found in Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to read you a passage which calls us to care for God's creation, to cultivate it, but also to respect it. Remember that God gave the land and its plants to the wild animals as well as to us. So we must respect that principle. In the Old Testament, Israelite farmers were to leave some of their fields fallow each year for the benefit of the wild animals. So we mustn't misinterpret Genesis 1 to say that we have the right to tarmac over every square inch of the planet. We are part of a community of creatures, and we respect that God gave the land to them as much as to us. I think it's significant that God says in Genesis 1, verse 30, "And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." Now, when he says that, he's talking to human beings. And it seems to me that the verse compels us to make sure that the habitats wild animals need should not be unnecessarily destroyed. In practical terms, I'm going to suggest a couple of ideas. I personally pray quite often for the scientists who work on a thing called nuclear fusion. The nuclear reactors we have at the moment spew out all sorts of nasty stuff, but there's a new form of nuclear energy coming out, hopefully in the next few years, that will give us unlimited clean energy. Now, I think that's important because I don't think solar and wind and batteries are going to solve the problem on their own. So I suggest we cry out to the Lord that in his mercy, he will help us to fix climate change through technology. Then we might consider some quiet changes in lifestyle. Changes made, let me say, without fanfare. No need for Instagram to know. One way for the Christian to witness in this world is to stop consuming so much. So have an old mobile phone. Don't spend ridiculous amounts of money on clothes. Don't insist on a hot holiday every year. To get a bit more specific, eating locally produced, sustainably grown food is sensible if God has given you the financial resources to make that choice. Short supply chains are always a good idea. This might shock you, but it is environmentally less damaging to eat a locally sourced bit of bacon than it is to eat an avocado. And that's just one of many reasons never to eat an avocado. But having said that, cutting down a little on the amount of red meat that we eat might be a good thing to consider. The big caveat to be placed on all these ideas is about money. All of us are worried about the cost of living just now. Inflation is probably going to hit 10%. And while it might be okay for reasonably wealthy liberals to install solar panels and batteries in their back gardens, that isn't a realistic option for everyone. I'll never forget a young Indian student intervening in a debate about veganism, actually. He says, "Your arguments make sense here," he said, "but they make no sense in my hometown, where a chicken is the most cost-effective way to produce the basic protein my family needs." So any moves you make should be done quietly, without fanfare, because not everyone can afford to make the choices you might be able to make. Okay, so we've asked three questions so far. Is planet Earth in trouble? What is our relationship to the Earth? How should we treat the Earth? But I have left the most obvious question to the end. What is the Earth for? Does it have a purpose? Now, when I summarize the talk in this way, it's obvious that I really should have started with that question, shouldn't I? But here's the strange thing. Those who claim to care most passionately about the Earth get irritated whenever they're asked about the Earth's purpose. That certainly is my experience. I've often found that I would say most green-minded activists are atheistic. Not all, of course, but most of them are. So they believe that the Earth is a sort of glorious accident, a beautiful thing thrown up by random processes. Now perhaps you think that here, you're here tonight and you think that. But if that's true, then the Earth can have no purpose. If something isn't intended, then it can have no purpose. It's as simple as that. If it ain't intended, it's got no purpose. And trying to think, to get you to think about purpose, I've been directing your thoughts to the beginning of Earth's story. But what about its end? The writer H.G. Wells wrote a novel about a time machine. And at one point, the time traveler goes to the very end of humanity's story. And all he hears is the wind and ripple of waves. No car horns, no bird song, not a single voice. Just a silent rock floating through space. That's how scientists tell us the world will end. Eventually, the lights will go out right across the universe. No stars, no heat, no life, not even a pale blue dot. I guess I'm really addressing the non-Christians in the room at this point. If the Earth wasn't intended, then it has no purpose. And if it just ends, then it has no significance. So why should you care what happens about the Earth? If the whole thing is just a blip between nothingness and nothingness, then why does it matter if the story gets wrapped up a few hundred years earlier? The atheist Carl Sagan saw the pale blue dot and thought it taught us that we are alone in a hostile universe, governed by forces too dumb even to know that we exist. In contrast, we heard those magnificent opening words from the Bible. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God intended this planet. He built it a bit like a stage on which the great drama of the human story could be played out. God loves his creation, and yet he allowed us to vandalize the earth, to fill it with violence and malice and cruelty and greed. I guess he could easily have erased the pale blue dot. But instead, he came onto the stage himself. That is the great story of Christianity. God enters his own universe as a man. In the person of Jesus Christ, God comes close to us. He enters into our humanity to deal with our sin and rebellion, allowing us to reestablish our relationship with our Creator. And then comes the great reversal. You see, in a fallen world, everything seems to end with decay and death. The little baby goat that jumps for joy one day will get eaten by a tiger, or it'll just collapse and die. But then, of course, one day the magnificent tiger will age and get arthritis. Its fangs will break and it will die. Man's days are like grass, says the psalmist. The wind blows and it is gone. The atheist says it's the circle of life. But at the heart of Christianity, we encounter the great reversal, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. It's impossible to overstate the importance of the resurrection in Christian thought, because it changes everything. The story of humanity will not peter out, leaving Earth as the silent planet awaiting its inevitable extinction. No, humanity's story will transcend death and reach into eternity. And we shouldn't think that we'll disappear off into some, you know, spiritual soup. The Christian hope of the future is about life on a new earth. The new Jerusalem descends out of heaven to the new earth, and that's where we will live with glorified bodies. We'll not be floating around in some dome of white radiance. The Christian hope of the future is about life on a new earth. The greys and the blacks of this old fallen world will dissolve away as we sang, being transmuted into the gold and reds of the new earth. Nothing good will be lost, but it will be a world free from violence and cruelty and greed. So I leave you with a question. It's actually the title of this talk. Does it matter if we care for the earth? If atheism is true, then the earth has no purpose or significance. It is only the Christian worldview that gives this beautiful planet the dignity that it deserves. And so I invite you to take your place in God's grand story of redemption, a story that begins with the redemption of your own soul and ends with the redemption of the earth itself. Now, I'm going to close in prayer, but I am conscious I've said things which I'm sure you disagree with, undoubtedly. So I'm going to be sitting at the front here somewhere, recovering, and if you'd like to come and talk to me afterwards, I would be delighted to talk with you.